Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. The period from the end of the Civil War until the United States became involved in World War II was a time of considerable change. It witnessed what we commonly refer to as an industrial revolution, which transformed not only the American economy and the way Americans worked, but also race, class, and gender relations, and as our guest this week suggests, the role and the image of the father. He is David Leverenz, the author of Paternalism Incorporated, Fables of American Fatherhood, 1865 to 1940. Following Leverenz's visit, Raymond Gesselbrock will step in to comment on paternalism in the White House, or how President Harry Truman raised his daughter. And historical hoax master Alex Berza will join us once again, this time to look back at a hoax involving the Cottingley fairies. But first, let's take a look at a few items of historical interest in the news. The elephant dung was no problem. When the circus came to town, Percy Skye simply showed up with a bucket and asked the keeper whether he could collect a few droppings. The mule's earwax, however, was a challenge, but he managed to get some and to deposit it next to the elephant dung in a new permanent exhibit on the history of contraception at the museum of the same title at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. In a 40-year quest to document the science and superstitions of family planning through the ages, Skye, a retired pharmaceutical executive, has sought out weasel testicles, hairy spiders, carrot seeds, and a bone from an all-black cat. He's found a prescription written in 1550 BC on papyrus, which suggests that to prevent conception, the person should moisten some wool lint with honey, mix in ground dates and tips of acacia flowers, and use the sticky wad as a vaginal suppository. He has collected hundreds of IUDs and cervical caps, and he has preserved the first experimental female condoms in the short-lived cervoscope of the 1960s, a device designed to help women monitor their fertility. The artifacts tell of a human motivation across the centuries, in different countries and in different cultures, to limit family size, Skye told the press. There are any number of museums that display fertility symbols. The story of how people tried to curb their fertility is every bit as important. And speaking of failed contraception, the oldest known copy of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter has been found in Natick, Massachusetts. One of Hawthorne's relatives donated the corrected page proofs in 1886 to the Natick Historical Society. The pages are covered with more than 700 proofreading corrections and comments many believe to be in Hawthorne's hand. The gift spent 118 years in a drawer until trustee Roger Cusifant came across the manuscript while cataloging the Society's collections. This is unique. No other page proofs of any of Hawthorne's novels or stories survive, said Chris Coover, senior specialist in rare books and manuscript at Christie's in New York, which has been contracted to auction off the rare find. Yet to come, John Herron interviews David Leverenz on Fables of Fatherhood, Ray Gesselbrock tells us about the relationship between Harry Truman and his daughter, and Alex Berza reports on the Cottingley fairies. You're listening to Talking History. How did the rise of corporate capitalism in America impact the role of men as fathers? And how has that influenced our view of paternalism today? These are just two of the questions Talking History's John Herron posed to David Leverenz in their discussion of Leverenz's new book, Paternalism Incorporated. Herron is a professor of history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
Within American history, few eras are as dizzy with change as the decades bounded by Reconstruction and World War II. The Civil War swept away the beliefs and assumptions of a previous generation, and for the next half century, the nation would watch in wonder as modern America took its distinctive shape. Among the headline changes in this period was a revolution in business and corporate culture. And as our guest this week argues, the transformation of the American workplace did not merely alter the economic landscape of the nation, but also affected class, race, and gender dynamics as well. David Leverenz is professor of English at the University of Florida. He is author of Manhood and the American Renaissance, and The Language of Puritan Feeling. His most recent work Paternalism Incorporated, Fables of American Fatherhood, 1865 to 1940, was published in 2003 by Cornell University Press. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for being here. That brief opening, I think, is at least a bit misleading, as your work seems less an examination of economics or working conditions, and much more on how the rise of a corporate capitalistic structure impacted American society. Is that a fair assessment?
It certainly is. I don't do any archival research, though I rely a lot on business narratives. But I am particularly interested in how changes in middle-class white men's working conditions affected conceptions of fatherhood, individualism, honor. And it also made it possible for women to enter the bureaucratic workplace and eventually develop professional careers. And my basic argument is that paternalism was a kind of transitional structure that controlled the threat and promise of these changes and developments. Angel Qualick Foland, a colleague of mine at University of Florida, says that a fourth of the male laboring population was white-collar by 1920, and Clark Davis in Company Men says that by 1925, one-third of white-collar workers were women, usually in very low clerical positions. That's an incredible cultural change, and I've been trying to look at some of the cultural ramifications of it.
Well, it's also a topic that hasn't got much scholarly attention. Why don't you lead us into this story? What questions brought you to this project?
Partly it was a kind of annoyance that a lot of people on the left were just dismissing capitalism out of hand. I thought things were much more complex. But then there were four or five questions that sort of converged. One was simply upward mobility narratives. There were almost none before the Civil War, and there was an enormous flood right after. That clearly had something to do with corporate capitalism. And the more original one is I noticed that in a lot of narratives, the Gilded Age, Sister Carrie, O Pioneers, ambitious young women were being presented as daddy's girls. And I thought that was really weird. They're Jean Webster's Daddy Long Legs. I have a whole chapter just on those four. And the obvious thing would be that it made women's ambition seem safer and more deferential, but it also articulated the possibility of it. One of the most interesting things that I think I discovered is that again and again, a great variety of narratives expose midlife paternalistic men as shaky, feeling that they'd failed at something, a kind of lack in the middle of their paternalism. One little thing that got me going along those lines is it blew my mind that Grant Wood's American Gothic has a father and a daughter in that painting, and it makes it so much more ambiguous.
Yeah, that's
anyway, that led to all sorts of other things. Daddy's Boys, a chapter on that, and why did businessman and the firm become such central cultural concepts? And then I got launched on why did rich men like Carnegie and Rockefeller want to give away so much of their money? So there were a lot of different questions, and they all converged into paternalism.
Well, key to all of that work, as you just suggest, is that notion of paternalism. And I think in today's America, that term has a negative and perhaps even ugly connotation. Give me a history. Has it always been so?
Yes and no. I mean, right now, paternalism is somewhere between boring and a four-letter word, and that's certainly right. It worried me all along about the topic. But at least in my reading of it, paternalism, the basic meaning of it is that it applies to any social practice modeled on the ideal care that a father gives a dependent child. And I'm arguing that it inheres in any structure of inequality, and those structures will always be with us, or at least as far as I can see. And in the South, they made it a great virtue, their care of the slaves, the whites did. And in antebellum artisan shops, ditto, it presumes a stable hierarchy of deference and mutual obligations, and corporations took over that rhetoric to discipline and control their workplaces. The big change, of course, is that in large managerial bureaucracies, the rhetoric of family just doesn't quite hold anymore. And Jane Addams's essay, A Modern Lear, in 1894, wonderfully exposes the kind of shaky narcissism of George Pullman's almost futile desire for gratitude, as she puts it. It just doesn't work in large institutions, and it leads to a lot of anti-union work. And that still persists in some elite institutions today, let's say English departments that are opposing graduate student unions. That's still a rhetoric that's alive and well.
Well, let's see if we can make this a little bit more concrete. Help me understand what the link is then between these larger developments in American capitalism and these ever-changing notions of paternalism.
Well, at one level, it's a field for expansion. I mean, this is the era of the great white father. Actually, this maybe goes beyond your question, but I see a relatively straight line between the Dawes Act, 1887, which tries to make Indians into property-holding individuals, and what's going on now in the Middle East as our government is trying to transform Iraq and perhaps even Iran into democracies along our own model. And there's a paternalistic edge to that in a much more national or international field. And it also obviously helps to control and discipline the workplace as women and immigrants enter the workplace at the bottom. And there's just lots of complex, contrary swirlings in it, I think. It shores up midlife manager self-images, it firms them up, shall we say, and it preserves men's feelings of father-like care in an increasingly impersonal workplace. So I see it as a large transitional moment that hasn't yet ended.
Well, you hit on a very critical point there, because within that structure, within these changing definitions of paternalism, there are tons of paradoxes and ironies. So it seems to me that American men would be given confusing and sometimes even conflicting messages about what role they were supposed to fulfill in society.
Absolutely. And those messages haven't stopped either. A man should be a rugged individualist, but a man should be a team player. You should be assertive and inventive, but you should know your place in the corporate structure. One of the most interesting ones is that you should be a good father at home, but also put more time into your career. One of the things that struck me is that American narratives, there are no narratives like Silas Marner or Trollope's Dr. Thorne, where you have a father raising a young child or a daughter in particular. Typically, at least in James, if you have a father raising a child alone, Gilbert Osmond in Portrait of a Lady or Dr. Sloper in Washington Square, he's evil, he's bad. And even Adam Verwer in The Golden Bowl, who has raised his daughter, you don't see that. You see Maggie, in a sense, raising him at this point. So there's a real sense that a middle-class father should be basically absorbed in work, yet should have some primacy at home. So I think those are lots of tension, a lot of tensions for women, too, I think.
Well, within those tensions, there's also an idea that paternalism isn't only going to influence the requirements for individual behavior, but also larger, much larger sometimes, political structures or cultural structures. For example, you have a link between changing definitions of paternalism and ideas of race in America.
Yeah, this is one of my more untenable arguments, I think. This giving and shaming chapter I have on white philanthropy led me into the idea that white racism at the turn of the century may be a kind of collective shaming to keep blacks in their place once the threat emerged of real equality. I call it a modern contact period. Du Bois talks somewhere about the increased interaction between the races leading to intensified, virulent feelings of racism. So I think this shaming is a way of preserving and perhaps even extending paternalistic structures of superiority and inferiority and prevent that equality and mixing. And I'd see that all over the place in literature of the period, especially the ways that in some ways black people internalize shame.
I agree. And those national ideas of supremacy that you mentioned that have a very concrete place in American race relations, I think, as you suggested earlier with the events in the Middle East and Iraq in particular, that it may be possible to take this dynamic much further. And can you speak for just a second on how these guidelines for personal action sometimes became part of the national political agenda as well?
I'm not so sure about political agenda, except the great white father image. And actually, that was enormously conflicted. Andrew Carnegie opposed imperialism in the Philippines, but on rather paternalistic and even racist grounds, as he said at one point, Americans can't be grown there. They just have to go their own way because they're inferior to Americans. It led to an enormous stress on passing narratives among African-American narratives. Just been reading James Weldon Johnson's autobiography of an ex-colored man. Students have been astonished that he doesn't get angry when people affiliate him with blackness. He could pass for white. He just gets deeply shamed and chooses to pass because he doesn't want to be affiliated with blackness. The whole uplift narratives, upward mobility to try to uplift yourself to semi-white status. So it certainly affects imperialism, but I think it also affects more, in corporate terms, the ongoing, what Clark Davis calls the Anglo enclave of top corporate executives in the middle of an increasingly multicultural society. I'm not sure that that gets what you mean by politics.
I think it does. And I think it speaks to much of these larger issues of how the tentacles of paternalism can extend deep into American culture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's sort of return more to the central focus of your text. And while these messages of paternalism were delivered in many forms, you argue that most often, or perhaps even most powerfully, these messages were delivered through literature. Why use literature as the vehicle to get to these different messages?
to qualify that, it's most powerful to me because it's what I know. I would certainly argue, and I think I said somewhere in there, that advertising or movies or architecture or any great range of things to people who really have sensibility that responds to it centrally would show just as much. But literature is what I think about. I mean, the book does end with Shirley Temple's Little Colonel,
right.
So it's one movie anyway. But it's basically literature is a lens, and this may get at my own midlifing that's partly prompted the book, to expose with a kind of distanced pitying the shakiness about achievement, about am I more interchangeable than I think I am. Also, Hurstwood and Gesichtekarry becomes a kind of primary feeling to get at what a workaholic culture does to a whole variety, again, of white middle-class men. And literature really opens that up with a surprising degree of sympathy. I was really surprised at that. Even from women writers like Edith Wharton or Willa Cather, there's an intimate connection between feelings of failure and paternalistic solace for a lot of men. And that intrigued me.
Okay. Well, within your examination of many of these authors that are members of the American canon, from Mark Twain and Theodore Dreiser to F. Scott Fitzgerald, and you just mentioned Willa Cather, within their classic works, are there standard formulas or are there stock characters that readers should recognize as delivering a particular message about paternalism or roles that men and women should take in America?
Well, they probably are, but I think I missed them. One thing that immediately comes to mind is actually probably tangential, and that is that when women writers are writing, let's say Kate Chopin and The Awakening or Edith Wharton's Summer, they will sometimes demonize women professionals as, Mademoiselle Reese in The Awakening or Dr. Merkel, the abortion doctor in Summer. There's a real animus against particularly Dr. Merkel. So there's something that's a recurrent motif. Actually, James even does that in Portrait with Henrietta Stackpole, his creative double. So that's one kind of distancing. And the other is again and again this sense of Hurstwood or Lawyer Royal in Summer or Dick Diver in Tender as the Night, this sense that as this move towards feelings of failure and inadequacy and chronicling some sense of kind of downward turn to that. But mostly what I'm just emphasizing is an extraordinary variety of paternalisms, from Longfellow's Children's Hour to Mark Twain's Angelfish Letters to Lolita. There's a whole sub-incest theme in a variety of these. Eve's Bayou is a nice movie in the late 90s. So I could see the sense of how paternalism becomes a kind of solace that has quite negative consequences for the people you're, if I can coin a phrase, paternalizing, but seems to be solacing the men. If that's a standard formula, that might be one.
Well, building off those standard formulas or even those reoccurring motifs, your study concludes in 1940, but can you still see a powerful impact of paternalism on modern America?
Well, I can think of a couple. Again, I mentioned the elite colleges that see faculty-grad-student relations in an apprentice model. And there's still ongoing Imperial America, Great White Father, Chapter 38, with a kind of added dimension there that white middle-class Americans were just shocked by 9/11. We experienced terror as a kind of national humiliation or victimization. I don't think that was true for many black people who knew terror from way back. But I think a lot of what this current election is about is the continuing to restore a feeling of national dominance, collective feeling of prowess, by kicking some international butt, and it really doesn't matter whose butt. And I think that Republicans have basically run with that narrative with great success over the last 2002 election, and I suspect, obviously my bias is the other way, but I suspect it will happen in this election too. And they've caught hold of that national narrative of collective imaginary dominance at some expense to individual voters' self-interest, and that rather baffles and depresses me, frankly.
I completely understand your sentiment. Well, thank you, David. I very much enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to David Leverance, author of Paternalism Incorporated, Fables of American Fatherhood, 1865 to 1940, published by Cornell University Press. This is Talking History.
President Harry Truman was a father in the time period David Leverenz writes about. So how does he match the paternal image Leverenz described? Raymond Gesselbrock fills us in, seeking to answer the question of whether his daughter Margaret was correct in saying that her father was way ahead on woman's lib, or if she was really a daddy's girl, as she also reported. Gesselbrock is supervisory archivist and special assistant to the director of the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library.
Margaret Truman said of her famous father some years after his death, he was way ahead on women's lib. But she also referred to herself, readily and with pride, as a daddy's girl. This seeming conflict between these two comments is resolved when one examines the relationship that Margaret had with her father. Harry Truman married Bess Wallace on June 28, 1919. This was a love match, and a child coming from such parents was probably going to be the center of their life. Both parents doted on their only child, but in very different ways. Bess was the disciplinarian, stern, domineering, impatient. She was always ready to lay down the law, Margaret remembered, reinforced by the hairbrush if necessary. Harry, in contrast, was the gentle father who defended his daughter from Bess's stern rule. Margaret's response to this upbringing was what one would expect. By age 5, she wrote in later life, I was a total daddy's girl. When Harry Truman became President of the United States on April 12, 1945, Margaret was 20 years old and in her second year at George Washington University. She already knew what she wanted to do after she graduated. All of her life, it seemed, she had dreamed of being on the stage, of being a singer, and that is what she intended to do. After she graduated, she went to New York to take voice lessons. Bess was not pleased with her daughter's desire for a career, but Harry felt different. You have worked long, hard hours to get your voice in condition, he wrote her. Your daddy will support you to the end. And he wrote her another letter when she was preparing for her first performance. Now don't get scared, you can do it. And if anyone says you can't, I'll bust him in the snoot. Margaret pursued a successful career as concert singer and later actor for several years. She was always very grateful for her father's strong support. But she knew he had something else in mind for her besides a career. From time to time, she would hear him say to reporters, I'd rather have grandchildren in my family than a prima donna. Well, finally, after about 10 years of performing, Margaret got married and over time gave her father 4 grandsons. When Margaret Truman gave up her performing career, she took up a new one, that of writer, which she has pursued with great success for almost 50 years. She is still today a daddy's girl who understands that her father wanted her to accomplish something in life.
You've been listening to Raymond Gesselbrock, supervisory archivist and special assistant to the director of the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library. This is Talking History. One day in 1917, 2 little girls living in Cottingley, Yorkshire, England, reported to their parents that they had been playing with fairies. When their parents didn't believe them, they grabbed a camera, went back outside, and took pictures of themselves with the fairies. Not long after, the photos were the talk of the nation. Here to tell you all about it, in another of his wonderful hoaxes from history, is Talking History regular Alex Berza.
By the end of World War I, the English were emotionally bruised and battered from 4 years of unrelenting bloodbath and horror. They seemed to be in need of something that would reaffirm their belief in goodness and innocence, and they found it in a series of haunting fairy photographs taken by 2 young girls in a garden outside of a home in Cottingley, Yorkshire. The 2 girls, Frances Griffiths and Elsie Wright, came in from outside one day and told their parents they had been playing with fairies. When their parents didn't believe them, the girls went back out, armed with a camera, and took 2 photos of themselves with the fairies in order to prove they had been telling the truth. The photographs showed the girls posing while delicate, pale white winged creatures danced around them in the air. A local photographic expert was shown the photos, proclaimed them to be undoctored, and soon afterwards, having received this stamp of approval, the fairy images began circulating through upper-class British society. Eventually, the photos came to the attention of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, author of the Sherlock Holmes mysteries. Doyle was a passionate believer in spiritualism, and he immediately latched on to the images, convinced that they were conclusive photographic proof of the existence of supernatural fairy beings. It became his self-appointed mission to promote the girls and their fairy photos. Encouraged by Doyle, the girls took three more fairy photographs, bringing the total to five, and within a few weeks they had become national celebrities, the focus of an intense and seemingly unresolvable controversy between spiritualists and skeptics. The skeptics were quite sure that the photos were a hoax, but they couldn't figure out how the hoax was done. The images didn't appear to be the product of any kind of darkroom tricks, such as superimposing images on top of each other or anything of that kind. It wasn't until 1978 that a researcher noticed something strange about the fairy figures in the pictures. They were identical to fairy figures in a children's book called Princess Mary's Gift Book that had been published in 1915, shortly before the girls took the photographs. Confronted with this observation, the two girls, who by now were old women, confessed that the fairies in the pictures were, in fact, paper cutouts from this book. The girls had simply posed the paper cutouts around them, holding them in place with hat pins so that it looked to the camera like they were floating in air. In other words, there was no darkroom trickery involved in the images, but there was definitely some less sophisticated scissors and paper trickery involved. To the modern, more jaded eye, the fairies in the photographs seem quite obviously to be fake, making it all the more incredible that the controversy surrounding them lasted so long. But the photos still managed to project a sensation of dreamy, childlike innocence. The five images remain one of the most famous photographic hoaxes of all time.
You've been listening to Alex Berza, author of The Museum of Hoaxes, a collection of pranks, stunts, deceptions, and other wonderful stories contrived for the public from the Middle Ages to the new millennium, and the curator of the virtual museum of the same name, located at www.museumofhoaxes.com. That's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona Beattie, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guest on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.